Let me ask you about your views of the discovery, the disclosure of documents, including exculpatory evidence. Is there tension around that? And there usually is in any criminal case,
It is.
but can you talk about that?
Yes, this is one of my dear or dar, you know, more important issue. There is a culture here at this tribunal of not disclosing. And I explained earlier that I think associating the defense to the process of discovery at an earlier sta at an earlier stage would be very important. But also, the prosecutor needs to be sanctioned for the way it has hidden. I'm saying hidden evidence in various trials, and the prosecutor has been sanctioned in other trials in the Ndindili manner. Now they have to, at a great loss, they have to recall 30 witnesses because the prosecutor was not able to do his disclosure job. In the Karamera trial, the one of the prosecutor one of the counsel there, Mr. Robinson, asked for the duty of disclosure to be taken out of the hands of the prosecutor because he was able to cite 20 examples where he was basically, I thought that was quite funny. He was writing a letter to the prosecutor saying, "I want this." He knew, he had found it already and he knew it existed. The prosecutor systematically failed in identifying the evidence which was either exculpatory or would be of some help to the defense. We'll talk a lot about the prosecutor, but the disclosure here, I think. The disclosure issue here, if it had been properly dealt with the prosecutor, would have allowed these people to have much fairer trial. They don't. It's a mix of, I think, incompetence and I suspect dishonesty. But there has been here too many incidents of evidence that turned out much too late, that's been not disclosed to the. We are dealing with that situation now. We have a detaining witness in our trial who I will give you that example. We have two witnesses who allege that Bichamu Mpaka participated in an event in a given prefecture. Two detaining witnesses. They came actually before the trial started. We had four witnesses saying that. Two saying he wasn't there, or that they did not remember seeing him. And people of the utmost, one who remained in Rwanda after 1994 and held a very high position there up to 1997. So somebody whose credibility is very difficult to doubt. And another one who held similar position. These two people, one saying he wasn't there, the other one saying, "I don't remember seeing him there." And two detainee witnesses saying he was there. Two detainee witnesses saying he was there. Eventually, one of those two detainee witnesses, out of jail, out of Rwanda, in a different country, corresponds with the defense, "I need to meet you," and explain to us how the evidence was fabricated against Bichamu Mpaka. And this was so, in many jurisdictions, you would get a mistrial and a stay of proceedings for that. The guy explained how authorities from Rwanda were circulating with lists of names to implicate. This is on videotape. This has been given. I mean, there's no, it's not me who's inventing that. So the guy says, these people, the authorities in Rwanda are circulating with lists of people to implicate in what happened in 1994. And what is even more worrying is tools, legal tools such as corroboration, where you have an unreliable witness, you're going to look for reliable evidence that confirms, you know, what he says. Well, if you take that against the accused, it becomes very dangerous because, aha, corroboration, we won't put one, we'll get two. So, and the guy actually states that they explain, to be more credible, we'll take two of you dealing with the same event and putting you at that place at that exact moment. So this guy managed to flee Rwanda, communicate with us, is filmed, prosecutor present, we are present, registry present, recall, can come back and explain the whole thing in a different case, and explains how you're in jail since 1994, it's 2000, 2001, you claim you have nothing, you claim for 5 years you have nothing to do there, they come to visit you in prison and they tell you, "Just give us a couple of names, go testify there, you're out." And they did, and the guy did and accepted to do it, but at least one of them felt bad and had remorses when he was out of Rwanda, okay? So called us, we got the whole information about that and explained that the other witness, that we still haven't, you know, that still alleged that, also did it with him. You understand? So this is when you, this is the thing we've been able to expose. Okay, how about these other where everything points to that? Witnesses would give like 8-9 statements, and at some point, boom, Bicha Mumpaka appears in his statement on the 7th statement, and one day after, another completely foreign individual, boom, Bicha Mumpaka appears in the statement. Same investigators, you can see it from the signatures. So it's, you know, that's why I'm we're talking disclosure and the work of the prosecutor. How can you take the two other witnesses who are one outside of Rwanda, fearing no pressure and telling you what the story was. The other one, I'm not giving you the whole story because I don't want to identify these individuals or what, you know. But anyway, the other one who should have been your primary witness for that event, which, and we called the two witnesses that were rejected by the prosecutor. They still rely in their brief. They still say this is an allegation that stands. They still pretend that Bicha Mumpaka was there, you know? It's just like, to me, this, what, have they seen the same case? Have they done their homework? I think, you know, there's no measure of objectivity if you present the kind of evidence which I've just given to you.
Well, let me ask you your view on that. Is that, in your judgment, a problem caused by individuals who are behaving badly, or is there something about the tribunal that should be adjusted? And what I'm getting at is, you know, if a prosecutor misbehaves, you would expect the tribunal to sanction the prosecutor and to say you're not following the rules. But the difference may be maybe the rules aren't strong enough, or maybe the rules aren't correct. Have you reached any judgment on that?
Well, it's very difficult to understand, you know, like I come from a jurisdiction, and so do you, where how can the guy still be in jail 10 years after the events, when that is the quality of evidence you're bringing against them? To me, this is enough said. You know, there's something not functioning about this tribunal if such a situation can arise. And now they're like, so they ordered investigation. We have no idea. We're closing. Can you believe it? We're closing this case without having the chance of hearing the guy who's recanting, because he disappeared again. He left. He disappeared. So, like, there is a fundamental problem with that institution, which is it's short-lived. It has to finish its work, you know, within a certain mandate, within a certain time, within a given time, with a certain budget, with certain means at its disposal. Which I think you cannot start an investigation. What you should do about that is stop it. We need to start an investigation in the practices of the prosecution, and a big one, okay? Because this is an incident which I heard. I told you another incident in another trial where they were ordered to recall 30 witnesses because of the prosecutor's, you know, failure to disclose. And these witnesses, the two I've been talking about, we just have the luck to be the fourth person against whom they're testifying, because the first one was found guilty. On the basis, amongst other, of the evidence of these people, we were just lucky enough to have a long trial, which made it so that we had the benefit of all their previous statement and to show to a certain extent, you know, the contradictions therein and all of that, and also the fact that we're still under trial when this guy recanted. But what about the first one? What about the first guy who was convicted on the basis of such evidence? There's a problem there. But back to sanctions against the prosecutor in the chambers, they're a bit. We have not seen, I think, what should have been done here, which is, you know, like something a bit stronger about evaluating whether or not you have still, you know, exculpatory evidence. There are Canadian cases which says that the evidence at the disposal of the prosecutor does not even belong to him. You understand? It belongs to the justice system to find out whether that person who's accused committed or not crimes. It's something which over which they sort of, you know, revendicate property, and it's very difficult. For example, now what's starting to dripping out, as I was mentioning earlier, is the involvement of the RPF. And statements, these failed investigations, which never led to accusations against the RPF leadership, were not, I don't know why, you know, I have my own views on that, but and nevertheless, there was a special unit or whatever of investigators which generated a few statements dealing with, you know, the means, how the RPF was leading that war. And that's very interesting, because that goes to how you know, our own side, the other side, was leading the war. And I think it's so relevant and so important to have access to that sort of evidence, yet the chamber doesn't want to push things back, the tribunal doesn't want to push things back, so they're trying to sort of not, you know, they're not going far enough.